so Muslim women can go to the beach. Nobody cares about the burkini.
Right.
But the 1%, the oligarchy, the people who control French media, you know, it's about six billionaires control something like 80%
right.
of all their media. It's this nonsense. It's this right-wing liberalist nonsense that you see all over the West, where this is what the Yellow Vests fought against. The Yellow Vests, one of their absolutely primary achievements was to put the issues of the working poor back on the agenda.
Right.
You know, people who make too much money to get, you know, any of the West's small social safety net, but they don't make enough that they can lead a stable life.
Right.
The working poor. Liberalism from 1789, all throughout history, since then, with the exception of what the French call the 30 glorious years, right. 1945 to 75, the era of social democracy, Western liberalism does not care about the working poor, even though they are obviously the democratic majority. So, and this leads to, what you were saying is, well, just as you said how the left abandoned the working poor in the 80s and 90s, the left doesn't, what the West calls left is no longer left.
Right.
It's about these woke issues. It's got nothing to do with the working poor. It's got nothing to do with economics. It's the same thing with the right. Is saying that the French government should be looking out for the needs of the French people, sovereignty, is that right wing? No. The West is in such a total state of disarray that leftism, which is there's a clear economic political spectrum. There's a clear left, there's a clear right, but the West doesn't know what it is.
Right.
They can't call a spade, they don't know what leftism is, and they don't know what right wing is. And this goes back to, and I talk about this in my book, this goes back in sort of, more modern terms. I mean, I don't want to get back into the Second Republic when liberalism, France was the only country that where their revolution in 1848, the revolutions of 1848, it's the counter-revolutions of 1848.
Right.
They won, but only in France, and France installed liberalism. And within 3 or 4 years, they were totally discredited. The Second Republic was pushed out. Because they saw right away, and Marx, detailed this in his history, that liberalism is terrible. It's just an aristocratic oligarchy. They knew this back in 1848, and they knew it starting in the 20th century. And what happened is you had fascists use the historical analysis of Marxism to say that liberalism is awful. Liberalism is oligarchy. Liberalism is imperialism. The French Third Republic that was when they were at the height of their colonial empire.
Right, correct.
The 20th century fascists, they used the tools of Marxist-inspired historicity,
Yes.
They combined it with racism, and they manipulated it. However, this is what the West modern liberalism still does. They still say Muslims, we need to invade them, we need to bomb them, and they need to stop trying to put Islam into politics. China, we need to invade them. Latin America, we need to still keep controlling them. What I'm saying is that liberalism subsumed fascism. Okay,
right.
Liberalism itself has fascist components, just as they worked with actual fascists after World War II.
Correct.
Yeah, we all know about it. This is why they're working with the neo-Nazis and fascists in Ukraine.
Exactly.
Because liberalism has subsumed fascism exactly in the way that it has subsumed monarchy. We Iranians, we know that monarchy is an evil. Autocracy is an evil.
Correct.
A quarter of the states of Europe still have monarchies. And the West doesn't realize how negative it is to how liberalism is so autocratic. And we see it right here. This guy right here, he has become the poster boy of autocracy. How did he do this? He sidelined Parliament by ruling by executive decree so often that it just inflamed the people. Last thing, Hollande used the executive.
Right. I just want to explain for our audiences. So what you're saying is that there's this facade of democracy and liberalism where you have divided government, you have a president, you have a legislature. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that that's not actually what happens in practice.
Precisely.
We have the Fifth Republic, coming out of the turmoil of the 60s. after losing Algeria and all the events that happened. And so some people have actually talked about this era of France being the post-Algerian era of France.
It's a good way to put it.
Exactly, yeah. Which then results in this turmoil in France, and then Charles de Gaulle comes in as a savior and creates this kind of imperial presidency. Mm. The idea that the Fourth Republic failed because the president wasn't strong enough, wasn't imperial enough. Mm-hmm. So if you could explain a little bit in terms of what you were talking about, the idea that Hollande, and then now Macron even more, is basically ruling by decree, whether it came to the labor laws, the reform of the labor laws, whether it came to the terrorism laws after the terrorism events and all those things. I remember you did a lot of good reports about that.
Thank you.
And so on. So if you could explain the idea that all these measures that are completely unpopular, do not have popular support, being pushed through and forced upon France by the decree of somebody we don't even know who his donors are. We still
undemocratically.
Don't
pushed through undemocratically.
If you could give a little bit more detail about it.
And then this guy is trying to tell countries like Iran or China or, you know, Venezuela, you know what democracy is. What you're talking about, the French imperial, imperial executive, imperial presidency, yes, that's the way that their system was set up. France, their executive branch has had more power than almost all of their Western counterparts for the reasons you were saying. And so there is this idea that if you are in France, you know, and you're the boss, you should have more power. However, it's really important to kind of realize that once the Lisbon Treaty started and, you know, Macron, the French president, no longer had control over his currency, over his budget, over his laws, the imperial presidency is in the past now. It's a historical footnote. Who the French president is now is more equivalent to a provincial governor, and he is beholden to Brussels, not to the French voter. And we see this all over the EU. We saw this with Syriza in Greece.
Ramin, let me just, I want to understand this correctly. So we have this idea that in the late, in the 90s and in the early 21st century, there is this idea that there has to be a neoliberal order. That system of having a welfare state that was created some sort of a level of social stability in European countries is no longer capable of why? Because all the resources are not going to the elites. So what you have is the EU imposing these rules and these regulations, and then in every country you have the local governments being the enforcers of that.
That's precisely correct. And this is why, you know, you have voter participation plummeting in France. You know, for the legislative elections here, they were the lowest, not only in the Fifth Republic, but the Third Republic, the Second Republic.
Right.
Because they know that people in Europe, this is what I can report being there for, you know, 13 years on the ground, they are realizing that their votes don't matter. That if they vote in a way that the oligarchy, Brussels, the 1%, the neo-aristocracy, any way you want to put it. If the people vote against that, Brussels will strike it down, or they will just legislate around it, or they will just ignore it. We saw it most famously with Greece in...
Exactly.
But people think, well, France is not Greece. France is, you know, eight times the size. France is mighty France. You know, Greece's heyday was, you know, 2,500 years ago.
Right.
No, France is just like Greece. They are, the French people are as powerless as the, you know, Greek people. And this is something that, people are getting, you might find this interesting.
Right.
Because you were talking about how the EU is the result of peace. Part of being PC in Europe is to not criticize the EU project because you're being then assaulted as, you know, a modern fascist.
Right.
Which is going back to what we're saying, how the definitions of left and right are immutable, historical. Go back to Marx, go back to Burke, go back two centuries. But the West has scrambled them all up. You don't know what it means anymore.
So let me
French people standing up for France is somehow racism. It's total nonsense.
Right. So let me see if I'm understanding correctly. So basically, we have this project being imposed.
Yes.
As this European project with all these lovely slogans, you have these local non-representative governments ruling in these different countries. And the result is this, that a very significant number of people simply drop out of the political process, which is maybe the worst consequence.
Even in a place like France, where there's so much political involvement, unusual in the West.
Exactly. Yeah. Or they move towards extreme right, who are promising them certain things that they no longer have in terms of having some level of control over their own lives, in terms of the government, you know, maintaining its sovereignty, its national sovereignty. Or in some cases, you see also going to the extreme left in terms of, and again, this might...
Where are they? Where is the extreme left?
Right. You know, maybe one of the places where actually it is a little bit more significant is actually France. I'm not talking about if you look at, for example, the parliamentary elections, it's still, the majority is still in the hands of...
Absolutely.
But you had a very sharp rise in...
But the French left, as you were saying, is totally discredited across the West. The Democratic Party in the United States is a joke. Labour Party in the UK is a joke.
Exactly.
The Socialists and the Communist Party and the Trotskyist Party are a joke in France. The French left, I'm sorry, the Western left is not left. They are discredited because they are not left.
Right.
Which means that they're not going to fight for the working poor class, which is what the average person is. The average person is still, they went from being serfs to being working poor. And so, like, when we talk about the French left, we are talking about, you know, we have to go back to 1789 until when they were really effective, when they really took control, when they really said zero tolerance for elitism, for oligarchy, for monarchy.
Right.
So...
It just doesn't exist anymore.
It just doesn't exist anymore, but the French, it's by comparison. A French leftist is way further to the left than an American leftist,
right,
or an English leftist, or a German leftist,
right,
you know? I mean, but when you compare them with a Cuban leftist, Venezuela, an Iranian leftist, of course, Chinese, you're like, my gosh, man, you're actually pretty right-wing.
Right, and the vast majority of them support imperial projects, of Western imperial projects, even in the left.
Every leftist party in France has signed off on Mali, the Central African Republic, absolutely, yeah.
Whether it's in Africa, whether it's in the Middle East, in Asia,
yeah,
all the wars that has been conducted, you very rarely see somebody, whether it's the Zionist occupation of Palestine.
Absolutely.
None of these things are considered to be...
However, you are totally right. However, we're talking about the political class, but the average person in France,
right,
their history goes back to being, you know, all of the... There were 7 European wars against the French Revolution. Half of them are referred to as the Napoleonic Wars. What I'm trying to say is, you know, they were the only revolution that succeeded in 1848. In 1871, the Paris Commune, you had French liberalists, and you never hear about this. You had the French liberalists colluding with Bismarck to lay a siege against Paris to stop socialist democracy.
Right.
You don't hear about these things. And then in 1917, you have, European leftism passed over to the Russians. But what I'm saying is you have 1995, enormous protests. You have protests against the restoration of liberalism, neoliberalism, in 95, in 2002, on and on and on. The French people, they have a political culture that, you know, just like the Shia have a different political culture. The French political culture, the French people, they believe in egalitarianism, égalité, fraternité, fraternity, brotherhood. The French talk about solidarity. You never heard an American talk about, you know, solidarity. You never heard an English person, you know, talk about this.
Right.
Not like the French people. So it's the way that they're thwarted.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
100 days after the killing of journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh, the Biden administration has failed to launch an investigation. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alice Sperry, writer. This article is published under the heading, Biden ignores the injustice of Israeli regime killing of a Palestinian-American journalist. Here's the story. Days after Israeli regime forces killed Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Aghaleh, the Biden administration has made no concrete effort to secure accountability for her killing, nor has it moved to independently investigate it despite dozens of members of Congress calling on the administration to do so. Abu Aghaleh, an Al Jazeera journalist and a household name across the West Asia region, was killed on May 11th while reporting on an Israeli regime military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. She was shot in the head while wearing a clearly visible press vest, standing nowhere near the fighting that had taken place earlier that morning. The killing was swiftly condemned by human rights and press freedom groups across the world. Within weeks, half a dozen independent investigations, including one by the United Nations, concluded that the bullet that killed her came from Israeli regime forces, with the UN noting that it had been well aimed. But U.S. officials have yet to take any concrete action over the killing by the Zionist regime of a U.S. citizen, and it's unclear whether they have any plans to do so. Last month, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with members of Abu Aghaleh family in Washington, D.C. after the request to meet President Joe Biden during his July trip to the West Asia region went unanswered. Blinken made no commitments to them other than greater transparency and more direct communication, which he promised after the family members noted that they were learning of U.S. statements on the killing from the news rather than directly from U.S. officials. Lina Abu Aghaleh, Shirin's niece, told The Intercept in an interview recently, "There were no promises made, no commitments. We expressed our concern. We expressed our disappointment with the way the United States has been handling the killing of Shirin, and we express how ridiculous it is that the family of a U.S. citizen still has to ask the U.S. to do the bare minimum. There wasn't anything of substance." Blinken told the family that there most pressing request, an independent U.S. investigation of the killing, was outside the scope of the State Department's authority and that he could not refer the case to the Justice Department, which would need to authorize such an inquiry. Abu Aghili said, the entire time there was a lot of deflection, a lack of answer. Since the visit with Blinken, the family has not heard from him, and despite his reassurances that he would keep them informed, they learned from the news that he had asked the Israeli regime to expedite a conclusion to its own investigation. But that's not what we ask him, said Abu Aghili, adding, because we know how that's going to turn out, we are not expecting anything from the Israelis. What we are expecting is the U.S. to do its job. The U.S. State Department did not respond to a request for comment. The Justice Department declined to comment. While in Washington last month, the Abu Aghili also met with more than a dozen members of Congress, several of whom spoke publicly in support of the family's quest for justice. Those meetings followed a flurry of statements and legislative efforts in the weeks and months since Abu Aghili's killing. To date, such efforts have included a letter led by Democratic representatives Andre Carson of Indiana, Lou Correa of California, and Bill Pascrell of New Jersey, signed by 57 members of Congress, calling on the U.S. State Department and FBI to investigate the killing, as well as a similar letter by Senator Chris Van Hollen and 23 other senators. After the U.S. State Department issued a widely criticized statement on the killing over the July 4th holiday, Van Hollen and others issued a new letter, asking a detailed list of questions about the U.S. government's response to the killing. Separately, Democratic Senators Cory Booker and Bob Menendez of New Jersey, where Abu Aghili had been a resident, also sent a letter requesting a senior-level classified briefing on the investigation details, including American involvement. Meanwhile, Carson introduced an amendment to the defense budget, supported by other progressive members of Congress, seeking to enforce a U.S. investigation into Abu Aghili's killing and any U.S. defense material implicated in it. After that failed, Carson announced standalone legislation seeking the same outcome. While these proposals aim to force the U.S. government to address Abu Aghili's killing, they are fairly limited in scope and don't address broader systematic human rights violations by the Zionist regime that the U.S. government could also address under existing U.S. laws, including foreign assistance and arms exports legislation. Abu Aghilis are not the first American family dealing with the U.S. government's inaction in the aftermath of a killing by Israeli regime forces. Last month, The Intercept published a long feature about the years-long crusade by the family of Rachel Corrie, an American peace activist killed in Gaza in 2003, to lobby U.S. officials for justice in vain. The Corries chose to break their silence about their private conversations with U.S. officials precisely because they feared that Abu Aghili family would be forced to endure the same ordeal. They shouldn't have to be asking the exact same questions we were asking in 2003, Sarah Corrie, Rachel's sister, told Intercept, adding, my question to Biden administration is, what are you doing differently for Shireen's family that you didn't do in our case so that they will get accountability? After their meetings in Washington last month, the Abu Aghilis felt that they had strong allies on the Hill, Lina Abu Aghili said. But so far, there has been no progress. The statements of support marked significant momentum around the cause that many in Washington have long been reticent to embrace, but they are only statesmen for now. We told the family after this trip everything's just going to come to a screening halt, and it's going to be on us to build it back up again, said Brad Parker, a legislative consultant at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has been working with Abu Aghles to coordinate meetings with U.S. officials, adding, "These narrow events over the years since Rachel's killing created these moments where it feels like there is this really significant step forward on the policy front, but then it doesn't really translate into concrete action. This is maybe the biggest test." For their part, the Abu Aghles plan to continue to lobby the U.S. government for action with what Lino Abu Aghles described as a mixture of skepticism and hope. If the U.S. does not want to conduct an investigation, what does this say? It gives the green light for other governments to target U.S. citizens, U.S. journalists, without any accountability? Our hope right now lies in the hands of the members of Congress who have the power to make a change. So, in a way, we are hopeful, but the U.S. could have done something from day one, and they chose not to do.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The fall of the U.S. dollar is happening, 1 cent at a time. While there is a decline in the U.S. standing as a superpower, there is also the harsh reality that the U.S. is facing, the decline of the U.S. dollar. All the signs are there. Shares of the U.S. dollar in reserves held by central banks has fallen to its lowest level. The U.S., the most indebted nation ever, also has a sovereign debt crisis, another sign that it may be heading to a dollar collapse. The U.S. use of the dollar as a weapon, like sanctions, has made other countries resist using it in their trade. Yet countries like Iran, Russia, and China are moving towards the elimination of the dollar altogether. This is why Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said, "Against the growing geopolitical pressure from the collective West, the only way to guarantee stable trade, economic and investment ties between Russia and its partners is to avoid the dollar and the euro and switch to settlements in acceptable alternatives, primarily in national currencies." His reference to the growing geopolitical pressure from the West are sanctions from the US and its European allies due to Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. But these sanctions have been heavily used against Russia starting from the year 2014.
When it comes to trade, if you want to move away from the dollar, as we're supposed to say, Russian ruble, it's going to be very difficult indeed. Of course, you can trade in ruble and other currencies, but the key thing is you need them to be liquid. That's to say, easy to buy and sell and a decent size. And also the margin, or the difference between the buying and selling costs, all of this can make it more difficult. Therefore, if you're trading in dollars, the price is normally going to be sharper. If you're trading in, say, another currency, well, you may find it's illiquid, as barren as a desert, and not be able to complete your trade.
The de-dollarization move was thrown into fast gear when the US Treasury Department decided to confiscate Russia's dollar foreign exchange reserves. This made other countries think twice about holding their reserves in the dollar currency. After all, these countries have concluded that their country could be the next if it does not abide by US foreign policy. They can be a victim of secondary sanctions at a minimum. Therefore, it was a natural progression for countries like Russia, China, and Iran to trade with their own national currencies. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Alexander Pankin has said that mechanisms for settlement in national currencies other than Western ones have been successfully created with a number of nations, and the possibility of paying in rubles for certain categories of Russian export goods, including energy and food products, has been set up.
It's going to be interesting to see actually what happens with the dollar now, because I suspect there's going to be quite a lot of weakness of it. Why? Well, because the global economy is slowing down for one key reason. But nonetheless, the dollar is normally seen as a safer haven than other currencies. So what you'll find is actually people will go to the dollar in times of emergency because they know it's actually got depth, liquidity, and obviously the treasury standing behind it. If you were using another currency, those things would not be as strong and it would not be as straightforward to be able to run a business like that.
The BRICS, SCO, and other international platforms have intensified their multilateral discourse on the subject. And this is very significant since the US has fallen out of favor with many countries and are gravitating eastward or away from the US. Take the case of Brazil. Presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has recommended using a Latin American currency to be free of the US dollar. Lula has pledged many things that don't involve the US and the dollar, such as strengthening its relations with Latin America, vowing to revive the BRICS system, integrating Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa in an independent economic architecture to challenge Western financial hegemony. The BRICS have also been discussing the development of a BRICS pay multilateral wallet and currency.
Early on Thursday, the Israeli military has shot down seven Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organizations in the occupied West Bank. The military broke into the offices of the organizations and confiscated property. Palestinian's foreign ministry has censored the raids as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice, saying rights groups remain the prime target of the regime because they document its crimes against Palestinians. Six of the organizations raided had been criminalized as terrorist organizations in October 2021 by Israel, which claimed they were affiliated with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. The groups have decried the move as politically motivated and baseless. The organizations targeted on Thursday work in fields such as human rights, prisoner support, children's rights, and healthcare. The organizations that have been outlawed by Israel are Ad-Damir and Al-Haq, which document human rights violations by Israel, and the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, Bissan Center for Research, DCI, Defense for Children International Palestine, as well as the Union of Agricultural Work Committees. The seventh organization was the Union of Health Work Committees. Since 1967, Israel has banned more than 400 local and international organizations, including all major Palestinian political parties. Analysts speculate that Israel had attacked the groups because they were becoming increasingly effective at exposing Israel's repression of Palestinian people.
That their Achilles heel is their ongoing horrific violations of human rights, which are losing them support throughout the world. And so they're apparently thinking that they can kill the messenger and get rid of those who are reporting on their crimes just by shutting them down on spurious pretenses.
The Israeli army has deprived generations of Palestinians in the West Bank of their basic civil rights, including the right to expression, regularly using military force to suppress Palestinian people. The latest raid on Palestinian non-governmental human rights organizations and their designation as terrorist organizations have been denounced by UN experts and were rejected by nine European states that fund targeted groups. The European countries also called Israel's allegations against the NGOs unsubstantiated. Last year, Israel's leading human rights group, B'Tselem, said in a report that Israel is not a democracy but an apartheid regime that systematically oppresses the Palestinians via military occupation and racist laws, is using laws, practices and organized violence to cement the supremacy of one group over another.
Israel is obviously trying to silence the voices of critics who've been documenting the ongoing abuses of human rights, the murders of children, shooting down teenagers, bombing targets and killing all sorts of people, often at random. They're essentially ongoing massacres, not to mention the torture, which is a systematic feature of Israeli policy.
Israeli policies and practices toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories should be scrutinized, but only condemning Israeli raids on Palestinian civil society groups is not enough. It's high time the UN and international organizations took direct action against Israeli atrocities.
Tensions are rising between Turkey and Syria. Ankara has launched airstrikes on military posts in northern Syria, killing several army soldiers and injuring several more. There are now concerns that a military operation in northern Syria by Turkish forces is imminent. Sources say a new cross-border offensive by Turkey looms large. Turkish forces have reportedly used loudspeakers in mosques in border areas close to the Jarabulus city to ask people to stay indoors in preparation for the operation. Reports also say numerous Turkish combat drones could be seen flying in the skies over areas in proximity to the frontier. Turkish soldiers are also mobilizing in most of the border towns of Hasaka, Raqqa and Aleppo provinces. The Turkish president has already hinted at a possible military incursion. On August 8th, Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Ankara's decision to establish a 30-kilometer deep secure line along the country's southern border is final. Ankara says it's going to curb Kurdish militants operating in that area.
They want actually to annex the northern part of Syria. This is an ambition that Turkey has to regain, to enlarge some territory that it once had. And I think this is not something that is acceptable either to Syria or even to Russia. Russia wants to have good relations with Turkey, but not at this price, I think.
The US-backed Kurdish People's Protection Unit, or YPG, militant group, which is the backbone of SDF, is present there. Ankara says YPG militants are terrorists. Damascus has warned Ankara against violating its sovereignty. Both Iran and Russia, which have been aiding Damascus in its anti-terror campaign, are also against Turkey's possible offensive. Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019. Back then, Turkish forces launched a cross-border invasion to push YPG militants away. Since 2016, Turkey has launched three military operations inside Syria. When the crisis began on Syria in 2011, Ankara backed militants fighting against the government in Damascus. For years, it provided them with weapons and military support in a bid to topple the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
So this is perhaps just what we sometimes call a red herring, that is something that will distract the observers from what is actually going on. It makes Turkey appear to be reasonable when in fact they don't have a reasonable agenda at all. They have an unreasonable agenda.
However, there are signs that Turkey may have changed its policy on Syria. Just recently, it was revealed that the Turkish foreign minister had a brief conversation with his Syrian counterpart last October. The top Turkish diplomat has stressed that there needs to be a reconciliation between opposition groups and the Damascus government. There are reports that Ankara was evaluating the possibility of starting talks with the Syrian government. The leader of Turkey's Nationalist Movement Party has also supported comments to mend relations with neighboring Syria. Turkey now appears to be in a difficult position. The country's economy is now in its worst situation in decades. It's spending nearly $2 billion in northern Syria annually. And sentiments against Syrian refugees in Turkey are rising. That could potentially cost Erdogan his political career. In order to fix it, Erdogan needs to establish relations with Syria.
I think it's going to be a major problem. The Turkish attack indicates that they are not going to accept a reasonable compromise and to respect the territorial integrity of Syria. So this is going to be a major problem.
But at the same time, Ankara does not want to lose Syria card with regards to anti-Assad militants. However, it's possible military adventure in northern Syria could trigger another catastrophe in a country which is in the midst of a prolonged crisis.
Tensions are once again heating up between France and its former colony, Mali. The African nation has accused the European country of violating its territorial integrity and arming terrorists. Malian Foreign Ministry has written a letter to the head of the United Nations Security Council urging the body to punish France over its interventionist policies in Mali. We have several pieces of evidence that these flagrant violations of Malian airspace were used by France to collect intelligence for terrorist groups operating in the Sahel and to drop arms and ammunition to them. Mali has called on the UN Security Council to ensure that France, quote, immediately ceases its acts of aggression. Mali has cited an attack on Tessit camp as evidence of the meddling of France in the African nation.
As to what gains France will have from arming the terrorist groups and operating across Mali, in northern Mali specifically, I think the French are very angry because they have been kicked out of Mali by the Malian authorities. And they are about to finish their evacuation, military bases evacuation from the country, if they have not finished already.
Mali says after the attack, which claimed the lives of 42 soldiers, quote, clandestine and uncoordinated overflight operations were conducted. Mali also says it reserves the right to use self-defense in the face of measures that undermine the stability of the African nation. France has, however, rejected the allegation, saying it's actually fighting the terrorists.
Essentially, the problem here is the French want to cling to the West African country in Mali and across the region, the Sahel region, for as long as possible. This is their traditional sphere of influence, and they would prefer to stay there.
The latest spat between Mali and France follows a barrage of accusations and counter-accusations between the two nations. France has apparently completed the withdrawal of its forces from Mali. The withdrawal has ended a 9-year operation in the country. France began its mission in Mali in 2013. The operation was aimed at eradicating militants that Paris claimed were linked to the Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France deployed thousands of troops to purportedly prevent separatist forces from reaching Bamako. But the war proved disastrous for Mali and its people. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. Anti-France sentiments are running high among Malians amid the rising civilian death toll. People were long demanding the withdrawal of the troops of their former colonizer.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries.
Mali fell under French colonial rule in 1892, which lasted until 1960. But years after outright colonization, it is still seeking to bring the countries in Africa under its colonial rule. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960. In economic terms, the former French colonies in West Africa are using a common currency that's controlled by the French treasury.
Well, Mali is very important. First of all, it was a French colony. Second of all, the French have maintained some kind of presence, military or otherwise, as well as political and diplomatic influence over the country right after its independence in the 1960s. And from Mali, they could do a lot of surveillance work, intelligence work, and military interference in other countries across the Sahel region, including southern Libya.
Critics say the currency channels more money to France and it strengthens its monetary policy on African nations. In order for that to change, experts say there needs to be a radical change from the past colonial policies.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered on January 23, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the eulogists of the household of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi on the occasion of the anniversary of the birth of Lady Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alaiha.
What stands up to Shaitan's camp? The camp of struggle and jihad on the way of Allah. Well, you are the hay'ats. You should ask your own hay'at where it stands in this jihad. This is the point I wanted to make. The second point is that we should ask ourselves where we stand in the battle that exists, in the relentless battle between Islam and disbelief, between truth and falsehood, and between deceitful and truthful narratives. We must determine this for ourselves and be sure, where do we stand? Of course, What is meant is the clarification and promotion of the ideals and main principles of the revolution. These are the areas where mostly we must determine where we stand. But minor political and social issues are also involved in this battle, and we should pursue these as well. Another point about the Hay'at concerns the speakers, the elegists, and the audience.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Two important solid pillars of Hay'at are the speakers and the elegists. I have points to discuss about the speakers that should be discussed with the right people on another occasion. I wish to raise two or three points about elegies, which are related to you, dear ones. One is that, as I said, reading elegies is a unique art. In other words, there is no art like it in other places. In other countries and places, they use the art of supplication, accompanied by mourning and weeping, but that is different from reading elegies. Elegies are of a different nature, and as I said, the relationship between the audience and the artist is a special relationship. It purifies and enlightens the hearts of the audience. The tears that your audience shed come from the heart. When hearts were being molded on that day, dewdrops of love were added to them. When the hearts were mixed with those dewdrops, they became like salted kebab. These tears originate from the heart and they purify it. In addition, elegies take the audience into the depths of history and do not let people linger in the present time. The elegists take people into the depths of history and show them historic truths. They also teach people lessons in religion, morals, and politics. An elegist does all these things. So elegies involve religious, moral, and political teachings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Brazil's presidential frontrunner has pledged to tackle hunger and ensure food security as the country has returned to the United Nations hunger map as a result of the neoliberal policies of his opponent, incumbent Jair Bolsonaro. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva says there's no explanation for the dire circumstances within the country.
This has to end because there are 33 million people without enough to eat. There are 105 million people who are suffering from food insecurity. And this country is the third largest food producer in the world. It's the first animal protein producer in the world. There are no reasonable explanation.
Lula da Silva was joined at his first major rally in Brazil's largest city by several towering political figures of the Brazilian left, including former President Dilma Rousseff.
Few days remain for the election, and we're going to have to go out onto the street and convince each and every person for their vote, because right now, voting is the only weapon we have. It's the democratic weapon.
Lula is counting on the support of some of the largest unions and social movements on the continent, whose leaders have vowed to return the Workers' Party to the government.
Right now, 60 million children will go to sleep not knowing if they will have food tomorrow and next week. We live in a country that won't take care of the country's greatest asset, which is its people. A government that doesn't take of its greatest patrimony of human beings is a worthless government.
All polls show former President Lula with a significant margin over Jair Bolsonaro, and Lula is continuing to gain ground and enjoys a higher level of support than the sum of all other candidates combined.
From here, we expect to see Lula embark on a Brazil-wide tour and meet with a range of sectors from which he seeks to lock down support. Camila Escalante from Sao Paulo.
The UK's biggest opposition party has entered into a membership crisis as close to 100,000 members abandoned the party over the past 12 months. On Tuesday, the Electoral Commission revealed that the UK Labour Party's membership fell by more than 91,000 in 2021, with a loss of income from membership fees contributing towards the party's end-of-year financial deficit of £5 million.
The question is, why is there a mass exodus of the Labour Party happening now, especially given the fact that over the past 12 months, it's been the ruling Conservative Party who have been embroiled in the majority of the headline-grabbing scandals? Well, speaking to Press TV, many former Labour members have informed us that it appears to be the direction in which the current leader, Keir Starmer, is taking the party in, which is proving to be a decisive factor for many.
Speaking to a former Labour member, shocking accusations of racism, Islamophobia and a purge of left-wing socialists has left a bitter taste with former Labour loyalists.
It's a witch hunt. There's actually been a witch hunt, and I firmly believe that currently in the Labour Party, they are actively on a witch hunt to wean out anyone who is not in line with their party. The leadership is taking the party down a route of racism, down a route of pure and utter Islamophobia. They're not only losing the minority vote, but they're losing many other people as well.
Labour's membership increased significantly during former party leader Jeremy Corbyn's term, swelling to more than 500,000. The lifelong socialist eventually handed over power following years of stiff rebellions from right-wing Labour MPs, who now head the party. The latest figures raise serious doubts of whether current leader Sir Keir Starmer could win an election when he can't even win the hearts of Labour's own membership. Robert Carter, London.
One year ago, following the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan, the US froze about $7 billion in Afghan central bank assets and cut major international funding to the country. The measure, which pushed the Afghan economy to collapse, faced backlash from inside and outside Afghanistan. In February, US President Joe Biden signed an order, splitting Afghan assets between relief aid to Afghanistan and 9/11 victims. On Tuesday, nearly 80 family members of 9/11 victims sent a letter to Biden, saying the money belongs to Afghans, urging him to release the money without delay.
In fact, no law, regulation or moral orders permits a country to freeze the reserves of another country and create a situation where the owners of the money face economic suffering. The money, which is blocked by the US and its allies, belongs to the people of Afghanistan. As I mentioned, based on the international laws and moral norms, the US doesn't have the right to decide on Afghan assets, be it keeping the money or splitting it between 9/11 victims.
In Afghanistan, more and more people are going without job and cash, as the US sanctions have paralyzed the public economy. Frustrated Afghans call for the release of Afghanistan's central bank assets and solidarity from the international community.
The US should solve its disputes with the Taliban. Why is it punishing poor